This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
In the first days and weeks after 9/11, we were glued to the television like everyone else.
As women lay dead in that rubble behind him, and women rescue workers struggled frantically to find them.
We didn't have money, we didn't have credentials, press credentials. We'd never even been to New York.
So there we are passing around her stinky fire boot, right, at this audience, and we were asking everybody.
So we land, and we get to our hotel room, and I sort of look at Mary and say, well, what's plan A?
Like an old Western where someone comes through the swinging doors, and the piano stops, and everybody turns around.
I think one of the biggest things that has changed for me since doing this project is that...
My life changed completely as a result of this project because I saw...
Because we were very different people by the time we finished this book.
Hello and welcome. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller. And this is a show about journeys, trips, pilgrimages, changes, happy accidents.
Happy accidents, flat tires, speed bumps, serious crashes, all those. And today, well, you know, the big news is about the Middle East, the economy, great ideas for making things horrible, the death of reason, that stuff. Which sometimes makes it pretty hard to celebrate. I mean, how dare you? Don't you understand that you can't change the world unless you stay miserable?
But our theme today is small victories.
Very small.
You can read it that way if you're the New York Times or if you're talking about the preservation of life on Earth. But it seems sometimes as if the only real victories are the small ones. Those moments that we can remember and taste and touch. We didn't include your small victory over the fence.
I finished the sanding and the priming and the painting of 120 feet of rusty steel fence just before the rains began.
The next day.
And it's beautiful. Three stories today. Two women for whom, among many others, September 11th was a turning point. A man whose life has been radically shaped by butterflies. And a dream about a great blessing that we never received, unless in fact we did.
First, the women at Ground Zero.
Mary Karuba is an investigative social worker. Susan Hagen is a freelance writer, and for the last 10 years, a firefighter. They're a couple, and on sheer impulse, together, they wrote a book. This is the story of that literal journey. It started on September 11th.
In the first days and weeks after 9/11, we were glued to the television like everyone else. And one of the things that we started to realize very early on was that we didn't see any women's faces when the rescue workers were being interviewed and talked about. And because I'm a female firefighter and because Mary works with a lot of women in law enforcement in her job as a social worker, we're used to going on scenes of emergencies and disasters and seeing a lot of women pulling up in police cars and ambulances and on fire engines, and it just seems so odd to not see any on the fire ground at Ground Zero. And we noticed that the language began to revert back to the 1960s language of firemen and policemen and the brotherhood and the brave guys. And the whole conversation about firefighters and police officers was pretty much out the window.
And we felt that the language really did matter. And these are not people, as we found out when we met the women, who are searching for glory or who even necessarily want acknowledgement. But to be left out so completely, we felt there was something horrendously wrong in that, and that women were literally getting written out of history. And a turning point for us was when Rudolph Giuliani stood on the rubble of the World Trade Center several days after the attacks and addressed a large group of people and asked them to stand and give a round of applause for the men we've lost and the men we're searching for. As women lay dead in that rubble behind him and women rescue workers struggled frantically to find them, that for us was the turning point and turned our irritation and our outrage into action.
You notice how calmly Mary tells that story. Well, I was sitting next to her on the couch, and let me tell you that the expletives were flying around the living room because we were really watching for that interview with a woman that had to be coming, and it wasn't.
When Susan said to me, "Mary, at some point you're going to have to let go of it because there's nothing we can do about it," we both froze. We both looked at each other. There was an epiphany that happened in that moment. Simultaneously, we looked at each other. You always say I say simultaneously wrong.
You do.
Simultaneously. There was something we could do about it. There had to be.
There was a huge event happening in American history, and women were being completely written out of their role in it.
Now, this all happened in an evening, basically. And we both recognized that there had been many times in our lives individually where we had strong feelings about something. We were passionate about something. But then when we sat down and looked at what it would take to do something about whatever the issue was, many times we didn't do anything. And so we felt with this experience that if we sat down and said, you know, can we go write a book, let's say, the answer would have been no. We don't have, do we have enough money to do it?
No, we didn't. We didn't have money. We didn't have credentials, press credentials. We didn't have the time off work.
Right.
We'd never even been to New York.
We had no contacts.
Right. We're native Californians. We'd never even been to New York City, let alone in the middle of a huge disaster like this, when media from all over the world was there fighting for press credentials. Who were we to think that we could get in and do these interviews and write a book?
So we made a conscious decision not to think about it and not to ask any of the questions. We made a decision that night to write a book called Women at Ground Zero. And so as a symbol of our commitment, we made plane reservations that night and hotel reservations, and we were in New York several weeks later getting started with our project.
And of course, Mary had been telling everyone who would listen that we were going to go to New York City and we were going to do this.
I was doing fundraising.
She was doing fundraising without my knowledge. Actually, I had my firefighting gear in the car one night, and she said, "Do you have your gear in the car?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Go get one of your boots. Let's pass it around. That'll be really dramatic."
So there we are passing around her stinky fire boot, right, at this audience. And we were asking everybody. If I was standing in line at the grocery store, I would get a donation from the person who rang me up and the bagger. And so we had told everybody. To completely back ourselves into a corner seemed like, in this case, a very appropriate way to go.
That was right on the corner where the towers were. I remember walking up, and as I'm walking up the street, the ground, there was like feet of just dust and paperwork and family photographs and just personal artifacts, shoes, clothing, all over Manhattan.
Of course, you know, the city was a shambles in all ways. And we had no one in mind who we were going to interview. We had not one name in hand.
Right. You know, what kind of idiots are we that here we are, we're risking everything. We ran our credit cards up to the limit before we even landed in New York, practically. And we knew that given the situation in New York at that time, with media there from all over the world, we knew that we weren't going to be able to go, like, you know, elbow Tom Brokaw out of the way or something and get interviews with people. We had a real moment of panic at the last minute. And there really was such a strange feeling in New York. It was too quiet. Everything was very subdued. And that smell in the air was just horrendous, the smell from the World Trade Centers. And so it was overwhelming emotionally from the very start.
So we land, and we get to our hotel room, and I sort of look at Mary and say, "Well, what's plan A?"
Well, when you are investigating people, one of the things you do when you're trying to find somebody is you try to think like them and try to imagine, you know, where would I be right now if I were that person? And so I asked a taxi driver to take us to a bar near Ground Zero where women cops hang out after work, because I figured there's always that bar. Right?
Mm-hmm.
There is on NYPD Blue. I don't know. There's always that bar. And this taxi driver didn't blink. He took us directly to this little smoky bar down by Ground Zero that was filled with off-duty women police officers. And I basically made an announcement to the bar and asked if there were any women there, police officers who had been at Ground Zero on 9/11. And if so, we needed to speak with them.
And at that point, well, first of all, when she stood at the top of these stairs, it was a smoky little bar, and top of the stairs, a jukebox was playing, and when the jukebox stopped, she made this announcement. And everybody just stopped and turned around and looked at us.
Like an old Western where someone comes through the swinging doors and the piano stops and everybody turns around.
It's exactly what it felt like. And then after a couple of beats of silence, three or four women got up and came toward us and wanted to know what we were doing. And so we told them about the book. We said, we're from California. I'm a firefighter. Mary's a social worker. We've been watching the news nonstop. We have not seen one woman's face when the rescue workers have been interviewed or talked about, and we want to write that. And they said, well, thank God, because no one has asked us. No one has asked us a thing about our experiences.
At that point, I asked, well, is sexism really more powerful than the media's desire to get a good story? Isn't it a newsworthy hook that, say, this little short woman goes into this dangerous building? That would seem like a really neat story.
Well, that's true. But a person only finds what a person is looking for. And so what we felt happened after 9/11 was that collectively, everyone was in such a panic that there was a way in which people reverted back to some comfortable stereotype in their own minds of the big, strong fireman carrying them down the stairs and away from the fire, that for many of us, there were no police women in our lives when we were children. There were no fire women. And so I think in a sense, there was an unconscious reversion to this moment of comfort in our lives, and that the old stereotypes were much stronger than this new idea of women as rescuers.
So with the women that we met in the bar, they put us in touch with other friends of theirs who had been there, and we began doing interviews.
I'll never forget that. I'll never forget the smell. It's just of all the dust and everything that's in the air. And every time the wind blew, you smelled the dead bodies. Knowing that I could have been my mother, my father, my brother, my sister, that what I was smelling was somebody who had life the day before.
And some of the women, we thought there's absolutely no way that they will open up to us. If this had happened in Northern California, everyone would be assigned like an individual counselor, therapist, massage therapist, you know, or a reader, everything else. Everybody would have a shaman or whatever their choice of spiritual healing might be. In New York, they had a mandatory session, one mandatory counseling session. It was so different there, and these were not necessarily women who were really big on sharing their feelings. And we saw women come through like Lois Mungay, who's on the cover of the book, who's the most highly decorated female firefighter in New York, and is the toughest talking little piece of work you ever saw in your life. And really, I'm not exaggerating when I say that she can actually create an entire paragraph out of nothing but the F word. I am not exaggerating. She has got a mouth on her. It's like a work of art, the way she speaks. And she came in and she said, look, I'll tell you my story, all right, but I'm not here to cry on your friggin' shoulders or nothing like that. I'll tell you what happened to me that day. You take it for what it's worth, and that's that. And we both thought, she is not going to say anything. And then she proceeded for 4 hours in our hotel room to cry and talk and cry and talk and to tell how on the morning of 9/11 she wasn't scheduled to work, but she heard about the attack. And so she rushed down to the firehouse, but got there a few minutes after the truck left with six of her colleagues that she had worked with for many years, and how not one of them came back that day. And if you know Lois, you know that she is someone who would have much rather been on that truck with them than to be the one left behind to tell the story. And she was brokenhearted at the loss. And so we found that with woman after woman, that they were just ready to open up and to talk, and we heard incredible stories.
We heard the story of Amy Monroe, who's a lieutenant with the Fire Department of New York. She's a paramedic and was setting up a triage center at the base of the towers when the tower began to fall. And when she finally found her way out of it, she was suffering from a life-threatening asthma attack. Well, she got herself to a hospital. She had an IV in her arm, and she had a mask on her face, and she was receiving oxygen and breathing treatments. And she realized then what had happened and thought to herself, I can't lie here in this hospital bed when my city needs me. And so she ripped the IV from her arm, pulled off the breathing treatment, and in a hospital gown, walked all the way home, where she managed to commandeer a fellow with a motorcycle who took her back out to the site where she got a new, fresh set of gear and was out all night assisting people.
Or Captain Terry Tobin. Terry was one of the first women on the scene, one of the first people on the scene that day, because she was only half a block away when the first plane hit. So she ran down there immediately and started evacuating people. And when the first building fell, she was hit in the back of the head with a piece of cement at such velocity that it cracked the Kevlar helmet she was wearing. Kevlar being designed to take a bullet. It cracked it in half, and that piece of cement lodged in the back of her skull. And she continued to evacuate people until a second building fell. And when the second building fell, there was a shard of glass that went into her back that lodged between her shoulder blades, and she fractured her ankle, and she suffered permanent hearing loss in one of her ears. And in that condition, she continued to rescue people and evacuate people, until she literally couldn't stand anymore, and they had to drag her down to the boat to take her to the hospital.
They ended up interviewing 30 female rescue workers who were there and the families of three women who died, all from a different perspective, a different location, a different function. There's a huge amount of repetition in the book, but it never seems repetitious. There's a sense of being in a world that's absolutely confusing, total confusion. Telling the story is trying to make sense of it. And extraordinary images from people who were not at Ground Zero.
Just showed us what a small world it really is in those
like
stories.
Maureen Smith, police officer, talked about working in the morgue and how she was having to voucher all the possessions that came through and body parts and all of that, and every single possession or thing that came through was a terrifying moment to her. This was the cell phone of Yumel Marino and whatever other possessions were there, and they put it in a bag, and once you put it in the bag and inventory it, you're not allowed to open the bag again. It's part of a crime investigation. You can't touch it. Well, the phone started ringing. And so all day, she and the other people there at the morgue heard the phone ringing and ringing. And when we, months later, when we interviewed Yumel's mother, Yumel's mother told us of that day, trying to call Yumel, calling her. And so there were so many crossovers like that in the stories where people were talking about one another. And us seeing the stories from an overview, we're able to put all those pieces together. And that's one reason it was so incredible for all of them to eventually meet each other, because their stories did cross.
Now, you could look at this different ways. One might be, wow, women can be just as heroic as men. Or, well, we pretty much know that mothers are capable of incredible acts to protect their children. Is there a sense, I wonder, where the human being, female or male, extends what they'd feel for their own children to people who are other people's children? Are our heroes of both sexes mothering?
So we came back, and now at this point we're broke, we're exhausted, we're overwhelmed, we're flooded with these stories. Now we're transcribing them. And one of the decisions we made early on turned out to be a really good decision. And that was deciding to donate 100% of the profits of the book, if there ever were profits. And we never had any idea it would turn into what it turned into. I thought 8 women in Berkeley would buy this book.
And we did what any new author would do. We went to the store and bought the Idiot's Guide for How to Publish Your Book. And we pretty much followed it to the letter. And we were fortunate enough to find an agent who got us a contract within a few months with Alpha Books, which is an imprint of Penguin Putnam. And they, of course, wanted the first half of the book in 3 weeks. And then they gave us generously another 3 weeks to finish the other half of the book. So we didn't get much sleep during that six-week period.
And the problem also was that at the time they told us they wanted the book in 3 weeks, we had already started making plans to bring all the women out here. We'd kid around a lot about the women and say, we should bring them out to California, you know, just really go all California on them. And we would just kid around about it, saying how healing it would be. And so as we talked about it, one day we said, let's do it. Let's do it. Let's do it in the same way we did the book. Let's make a commitment to bring all the women at Ground Zero to California for an all-expense-paid week in the wine country, and we decided to do it.
You see, it was very difficult for us after hearing their stories and having such intimate conversations and connections with them in New York City to walk away and not feel like we could give them something. So we sent a nice letter inviting them all here, thinking that maybe a few would accept because, after all, you know, they've got a job to do. Most of them have not been out of New York City. And, you know, the RSVP cards started rolling in and everybody said they wanted to come.
We almost left the country. I am not kidding. We were so terrified. I wanted to move to Japan. I could not believe that they all said they were going to come. I mean, we wanted to invite them. We just didn't believe they'd actually all come. And so we ended up with 35 people were coming to California from New York for an all-expense-paid week in the wine country. And we met with a friend of ours who's a professional fundraiser and told her what we had done. And she was horrified. She couldn't believe we had already done it without talking to her, at least.
She says, if you guys are going to do a party this big, you really need to have a budget up front. Do you have a budget? And we said, no. And she did a couple of quick calculations and said, well, I think you're going to need to raise about $100,000 in order to make this happen.
So we started talking to everybody, Seroptimus, Rotary, any kind of club where people sat down and met and had money to donate. We talked to everybody. I thought Seroptimus was a group of cheerful people. I really did.
And meanwhile, we learned that Healdsburg had just hired its first woman police chief. Chief Susan Jones. So we called Chief Jones and went and had lunch with her and told her about our plan. And she said, well, Healdsburg is the town to host them. So Healdsburg became the destination. We raised enough money to give each woman a suite in the beautiful, very opulent Healdsburg Hotel.
And the women could not get over it. Some of them said that the bathroom in their suite was almost as big as their apartment back in New York. And we had them out at wineries every day. They were just treated like gold. We had so many donations and had so much left over that we started a Women at Ground Zero scholarship fund at the local junior college for young people wanting to go into public safety training programs. The women's reaction to California was just priceless because people just fawned all over them. They couldn't take it in hardly because they're used to being in New York, where usually if someone has something to say to them, they're usually yelling something scatological in their direction. They don't get a lot of pats on the back. The day that we left Healdsburg to go to the airport, they were given a full police escort to the airport. And on our way out of town, we see a ladder truck with its ladder fully extended across the road. And standing on the side of the road, firefighters and police officers and paramedics saluting the women as they left town. And the whole bus just broke down. We did. They did. We all just lost it in that moment because it was a moment in which they were acknowledged and seen for who they are and what they did. And so we were able to all cry together that day.
And you know, frankly, many of the women are still suffering. Some continue to have physical problems. Some have been forced to leave their jobs because of irreparable physical ailments, injuries. Many of them still deal with the demons that can come to visit after an event like this. And, you know, no one will ever forget. It continues. It will be there for the rest of their lives.
I'm walking. I look over at this car. There's this big chunk of meat, big chunk of body part. And I was an anatomy student, and I couldn't make out this part. I said, is that a human being? They go, we think it's part of a torso. And then we found one a lieutenant that worked in headquarters. We put him in a body bag. And then we found a civilian next to him, and we scooped them up with shovels and put them in a body bag. And after that, it was just finding pieces, any kind of flesh that we could find for DNA.
Well, the book is in its second printing now, and we've really been amazed at the response. The funniest thing that people asked us was that we really saw the media's hunger for something kind of controversial or something sort of meaty, because at one point in the book, we said that we were outraged at the lack of coverage of women. And every single place we were interviewed, the interviewer asked almost immediately, well, we understand you are outraged about what happened. Can you tell us about your outrage? Remember, every single place wanted to know about our outrage. And by then, we had sort of gotten over our outrage.
Yeah, at first, we were very taken aback by that because we kind of thought, was there outrage? Because our emotions had shifted so much through this process. Now, we were just, you know, our hearts were just laid bare. And our emotions were all over the place. And we cried at the drop of a hat. And so to have a reporter say, tell me about your outrage, we really had to reel way back into our memories to remember what that felt like, because we were very different people by the time we finished this book.
And a huge surprise for me was their reaction to the terrorist attacks themselves. Before we went to New York, I had really steeled myself because I'm half Arab, half Irish. I was raised with the Arab side of my family. But because I don't look Arab, people say all kinds of racist things in front of me at times. And the thing that surprised me was that I never heard one word of any of that ever from one of these women. And what I saw was that the closer that one got to the heart of the tragedy, the more that what was pulled out of that tragedy was the message of love and tolerance. And those women said to us, almost to a person, that what they learned was to love the people in your life as if there is no tomorrow. And the further out you get from the heart of the tragedy and go other places in the country, the more you hear talk of revenge and hatred, and we got to go turn Afghanistan into a parking lot. And we never heard one word of that from them.
I think one of the biggest things that has changed for me since doing this project is that I've really listened to the advice given to us by these women. And it seems so corny and trite to say, not to sweat the small stuff, but that's really true. It's really true for me. I have a friend who parks her car a great distance from any doorway of any store or place that she goes because she's so worried that there will be a ding on the door. And I have a new car, and I don't care what bird poops on it. I mean,
my life changed completely as a result of this project because I saw the power of acting on the intensity of your passion if you act without hesitation. It is amazing how the entire world seems to conspire to help you do whatever it is you're trying to do. The doors that opened for us, the serendipity of so many experiences, it all pointed to the idea that the world really wants to help you live what your truth is. And I had always clipped out those sayings of move forward confidently in the direction of your dreams and do what you love and the money will follow. And I had it up on my refrigerator magnet like everybody else. And this was the first time in my life that I really experienced it at a very profound level. And it changed the way I approach everything.
I like that. That and the thing about the bird poop. I really like those. The bird poop on the car. My life has changed. I don't care about bird poop anymore in my car.
Didn't you know I'd have to have at least one of those in there?
That was classic.
We were just wrapping up when they mentioned that they'd been together as a couple only 8 months before 9/11. That's not a lot of time to prepare for this challenge.
It's not, and we definitely had some moments of challenge, like when we were in New York, the first time that we went to New York, I was wild on the internet trying to find people and track down resources, and I remember one night, it was like 1:30 in the morning, I'm on the internet, and I asked Susan something, she's going into bed, and so I asked her, well, what do you think about such and such, and she said, Mary, I'm exhausted, I need to go to sleep, let's talk about it tomorrow. That was at 1:30. So then, at 5:30, I'm back up again on the computer, and I hear Susan rustling. She gets out of bed, and she's on her way to the bathroom, and I started to ask her, what do you think about this, that, and the other thing? She said, Mary, I haven't even had a cup of coffee yet. I need some time. Now, I just exploded and said, well, if I can't talk to you last night, and I can't talk to you now, when is my window of opportunity to speak to you about these things? And Susan said, well, your window of opportunity is like between 5:30 in the morning and 1:30 in the morning. It's a really big window.
Now, just let me go to the bathroom and get a cup of coffee.
In Sebastopol, California, we were talking with Susan Hagen and Mary Karuba. You can visit their website at www.womenatgroundzero.com. And of course, their book Women at Ground Zero is available everywhere. It's very moving and very beautiful.
This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.